Alaskans, we're still dealing with a pandemic. Longer nights and seasonal affective disorder don't make it any easier. We encourage you to take care of both your mental and physical health this winter. Get outside. Enjoy traditional foods. Connect with your community. And keep your body moving. Let's take care of ourselves and each other.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Alyssa Yakyadi London. Recognition of the value of traditional knowledge is gaining momentum among elected leaders and in academia. The Biden administration issued an Indigenous knowledge statement saying it's an important component to the nation's scientific, technical, and economic advancements. Today, we'll learn more about the importance of Indigenous science and its place in scientific progress.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A government boarding school for Native children in Wrangell was one of the first of its kind in Alaska and operated for 43 years before closing in 1975. Now, there are plans to redevelop the site of the former Bureau of Indian Affairs facility. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, sensitivity towards the legacy of abuse and trauma and recent discoveries of graves at former residential schools in Canada have caused local officials to tread carefully before breaking ground.
When the city and borough of Wrangell applied in May for a federal wetlands fill permit to start developing the 134-acre former Wrangell Institute property, the Army Corps of Engineers stated it was unaware of any cultural resources at the site. But days later, news broke of a grisly discovery in Canada. The remains of more than 200 Native children were found on the grounds of a former residential school in British Columbia. In the following weeks, more than 1,000 bodies would be discovered at the sites of former residential schools across Canada, shedding light on the country's dark history of mistreatment of Indigenous peoples. The discovery brought the redevelopment process of the former Institute property to a halt, while federal and state investigations comb records and survey the grounds for cultural resources or hidden burial sites. Esther Reese, whose Tlingit name is Achsin, is the tribal administrator for the Wrangell Cooperative Association, Wrangell's local tribe.
We're just happy to be able to work with the city on something that's of critical importance and a sad part of history of our people. So it's very appropriate that the city is working with the tribe on it.
Located at a Tlingit site known as Kishangitaan, or Aldertop Village, the boarding school opened in 1932. It was not affiliated with any particular religious denomination, although federal records show Wrangell's Catholic priest in the late 1930s took an interest in the school and incorporated it into his parish. The Wrangell Institute was one of about 20 residential schools for Alaska Natives that operated through the 20th century. Its enrollment peaked in the mid-1960s with just over 260 students from 5 to 15 years old. The Institute housed more than Native children. During World War II in 1942, Unangah people who were forcibly relocated from their homes stayed in tents on the Institute grounds. State-collected and individual records recall intense physical, sexual, and emotional abuse of Wrangell Institute students. Students were beaten for speaking their first languages, survivors told KSTK in 2016. Reese says Wrangell's tribe is working with the city to contact tribal entities who had children sent to the school.
What the tribe is looking at is consultation with affected tribes and then construction of a memorial gazebo honoring all the tribes that attended the Institute and then doing a healing ceremony.
There's a lot of work and healing to do before the property could be redeveloped. That includes survey work, as well as collecting comments and stories for a memorial that will speak to its history before the ground is repurposed for the future. For National Native News in Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and the Department of the Interior are collaborating to strengthen information sharing involving Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland's national investigation into U.S. Indian boarding schools. The organization has been researching and sharing information on U.S. Indian boarding schools for years, which includes more than 300 known schools. Haaland's investigation is collecting new information and opening federal records to be analyzed. In June, Haaland announced her boarding school initiative, which directs the department to prepare a report by April 2022. The organization and federal agency signed a memorandum of understanding on Tuesday to share records and information. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States, and you may choose which booster shot you receive. More info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Support by Canyon Records, producer of Native American music, including 8-time Grammy nominee Northern Cree and Nitsanook. Powwow songs recorded live at Shakopee. All Canyon titles available at iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and CanyonRecords.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling, and I'm Alyssa London. Indigenous people have always understood the world they lived in. We studied our relationships with the land, plants, and animals. We cultivated food, developed agriculture, and understood migrations, and the weather, and the stars. This knowledge is a large part of what still gets passed down from generation to generation. And historically, there's very little mention of Indigenous science and knowledge in Western academia. But that's changing as more Indigenous scholars enter the sciences. As Indigenous librarian in Canada created a way for researchers to attribute knowledge from elders and oral teachings. And we'll hear about that in a minute. And a recent initiative from the Biden administration calls for federal agencies to recognize the importance of Indigenous traditional ecological knowledge. How do you think traditional knowledge from your Native community can be beneficial to others? Join our conversation by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Now, our first guest today is Laricia McLeod. She's a learning services librarian at the Alberta Library, and she's a member of the James Smith Cree Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Laricia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. So you came up with a way to cite Indigenous knowledge. Can you tell us what this means?
Yeah, so it's actually just templates that work within two of the very popular citation styles used in academia. APA and MLA are what they are usually just called. They're the citation styles of the American Psychological Association and the Modern Language Association. So they tell you ways to cite things like books and articles, but something that was really missing was a way to really cite something like an oral teaching in a way that really treated it with the same respect as a journal article or a book.
And why wasn't there a way to cite Indigenous knowledge before?
Honestly, I think it comes down to the fact that the roots of academia are built on a foundation of excluding Indigenous people and really extrapolating Indigenous knowledge from communities and representing it as, you know, traditionally it's been white academics as their knowledge, especially when you look at things like the science and biology.
And can you tell us more about the templates that you created?
Yeah, so I created the templates and discussed them with, at the time I was working at an institution called Norquist College in Edmonton, Alberta, and there was an Indigenous student center, so I really got to discuss them with the staff there, as well as the elder in residence, Dolores, and really, they follow the similar templates to something like a book, but they try to include like relationships that matter to us. For example, including a spot where you're able to note who the nation or community of the individual is, or where they physically live, because the relationship to the land can be really important, especially depending on the teaching that they're talking about. So I even included some guidelines around if they have a title or status, or even if they have a name that is written in a different alphabet or an indigenous language. So really trying to just include a lot of flexibility while still making it very familiar to those who are used to citing things. So, you know, it's not going to look out of place next to books and journals, but it really focuses on the relationships that matter to us.
That's great. And can you tell us more about the elder in residence that you mentioned, how important it is to collaborate with those individuals?
Of course, yeah. Dolores Cardinal was actually really fantastic to work with. And she actually was, I went and talked to her about, in terms of putting the examples up on the Norquist Library website, whether or not she would be willing to be the example. Because, of course, academia has an unfortunate history of taking our names and using them how they please without necessarily asking. So, you know, we had a discussion about it. We also discussed the different elements in the citation to make sure that, you know, she also felt like they represented relationships that were important, and also just generally discussing like why citation matters for Indigenous knowledges.
And what drew you to get involved in this work?
I think it really harkens back to when I was doing my bachelor's degree, and I was very lucky to have some really great archaeologists who were, I would say, lovingly critical of their own field. Archaeology in particular is one of those fields that hasn't had a great relationship with Indigenous people or knowledges. And Dr. Jack Ives and Dr. Keisha Supernaut at the University of Alberta were teachers who, while teaching me the fundamentals of archaeology, were also really talking about the importance of community engagement and the limitation that academia currently had in terms of recognizing the importance of Native voices, especially on, you know, our own stories, our own history, that hold nothing about us without us. And so I think they really kind of planted the seed that there needed to be some changes made in academia. And it just didn't really fully sprout until after I had finished my master's degree in library studies and realized I had become that kind of person that could try and make this change, or at least put forward the change into the world and hope that others would, you know, take up the challenge and would also support it.
So prior to you leading the charge on this, there was no way to cite Indigenous knowledge in research and academic work. Is that correct?
There was sometimes ways around it. If you were able to record or transcribe, sometimes you would be able to cite it. Otherwise, you would end up citing it as something called personal communication, which effectively puts it on par with having a chat with someone in an elevator, where it only appears in the text of, like, the body of an article and doesn't appear actually in the reference list. So that already kind of puts it on a different level of respect and importance than something like a book or a journal, which doesn't really feel appropriate, especially for our oral teaching. And other than that, a lot of times it was PhD students who were trying to include their traditional knowledge would have to come up with their own way to cite it and would have to try and convince their thesis review committee to accept that citation. So it really put a lot of the time and effort on the individual Indigenous scholars, which just didn't feel like was right.
No, not at all. What then drew you initially to the field of library and information science?
So it's actually the family business for me. My dad is a librarian. My mom worked, my grandmother worked in libraries. Many of my aunts do. My sister just recently joined the field as well. So I guess I always knew it was important, and I also knew there wasn't enough Indigenous librarians. I was really lucky because I had my dad as this great role model that showed me that you could be Indigenous and be a librarian. But until recently, there were less than about 50 Indigenous librarians across Canada.
Wow, that is not enough at all. And but do you think that there is greater interest in Indigenous knowledge and collaborating with Indigenous librarians in light of climate change? Or are there any external factors that you think are causing people to want to look to Indigenous knowledge more?
I definitely have seen a renewed interest. Obviously, the work that I did with Youth Citation Templates was originally back in 2018. And originally, there was this kind of big burst of interest, and then it sort of quieted down. So I think this recent, you know, renewed interest that I'm super excited to see, I think it is in part because of climate change. I hope that part of it is also about, you know, the International Decade of Indigenous Languages. I honestly think some of it also has to do with, as we're dealing with things like residential school findings, being able to properly acknowledge people's stories, even if they can't be written down and are only shared orally. I think that might also be part of this renewed interest. But yeah, I think it's kind of a lot of things all coming together at once.
Makes sense. And I know you created the templates. Is there anything that you're working on now to make it easier, like building on that work for people to cite Indigenous knowledge in their research and academic work?
That's actually a great question. I had someone point out to me that it would be really great if in citation tools like Zotero, that these templates would be able to be embedded in those. So those being softwares that you can use to help you make your citations. So, of course, having these kind of templates built in would be super helpful. So I'm currently in discussion with them trying to get that implemented, because anything to make it easier for the scholars is my goal. And then, of course, I did it for APA and MLA because that was the styles that were used at the institution I was at, but I'm happy to work with anyone for other styles. I have a colleague who took these and adapted them for Chicago-style citations because that was what was used at their institution. So I'm happy to help and support anyone who, you know, wants to adapt them for whatever style their institution used too.
That's great. We're going to go to break now, but there's obviously more to learn from you and the other guests on our show today. This is Native America Calling. We'd love to hear from you today. So you can call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE, and we'll get your comments on the air. And you can interact with us on Instagram and Facebook at Native America Calling and tag me, your host, Alyssa K. London. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. Native Americans continue to suffer serious brain injuries far more than the general population. But there are advancements in both prevention and treatment that offer promise for closing the gap. We'll find out more about brain injuries on the next Native America Calling.
The COVID-19 vaccine rollout for children ages 5 to 11 years old is already well underway. Children who get the vaccine will receive strong protection against the COVID-19 disease, and getting children vaccinated will help keep all members of our communities safe. You can contact your child's health care provider or tribal health department to schedule their vaccine appointment today. Support for this program is provided by the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health.
You're listening to Native America Calling, and I'm Alyssa London. We're talking about Indigenous knowledge today. And if you're allowed to share, what's something your people have always known about that conventional science and researchers are still trying to understand? Join our conversation by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Now, before the break, we were talking with Larissa McLeod. She's a learning services librarian at the Alberta Library. She's also a member of the James Smith Cree Nation. And now we're also going to bring into the conversation from Rio Rancho, New Mexico, Dr. Gregory Cajete. He's a professor emeritus and former director of Native American Studies at the University of New Mexico. And he's from the Santa Clara Pueblo tribe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Dr. Cajete.
Well, thank you. For having me. I'm very happy to share my thoughts and perspectives on this subject.
Thank you. And we're looking forward to hearing your thoughts and perspectives on this subject. So to kick us off, to get your thoughts going, sharing with the audience, how do you refer to Indigenous knowledge and how universal is it to academia and to understanding our modern world?
Well, first I want to say that Indigenous knowledge is very extensive, and in terms of at least Native people, and it actually is a misnomer to just call it Indigenous knowledge. It's really Indigenous knowledges, because there are as many forms and expressions of Indigenous knowledge as there are tribes, and. And I think that's one very important point. In terms of academe, Indigenous knowledge has actually just begun to come into conversations, you know, in terms of mainstream academe. It's usually been a subject that was marginalized to anthropology, archaeology, sometimes history. But in recent decades, it has become more and more a part of many kinds of research projects, particularly in academia. So I echo some of the perspectives of Larissa in her presentation on the need for a proper citation of Indigenous knowledge in the context of academia. But that being said, you know, I've been in the field for, or at least working in the area of Indigenous knowledge for, oh my goodness, about 48 years now, I think. I've been a teacher, first starting out at the Institute of American Indian Art, and then on into the University of New Mexico in Native education and also in Native studies. And I've really seen some real evolution, you know, in terms of how Indigenous knowledges are received in the context of academia. There's still a lot of work that has to be done, but I think that it's very promising that President Biden, you know, has put forward his proclamation that Indigenous knowledges should be respected and should become a part of the conversations, at least in academia and in the scientific fields as well. I did write a book in 2000 called Native Science, Natural Laws of Interdependence, in which I just echoed the histories of Indigenous people in the area of science that is just coming back into popular use. It was what we would call a underground book. Many Native people knew about it and used it in their work, but it was not anywhere near a mainstream kind of it didn't have mainstream reception. Let's put it that way, in terms of how it was received in Western academia. But I think that's changing. In many ways, climate change, you know, certainly has been a catalyst for both Native people as well as non-Native people to begin to take note of Indigenous forms of knowledges, especially the worldviews that we as Indigenous people have in common, and that really is the worldview of relationality, relationship with the natural world in sustainable and nourishing ways. And so you find that perspective, that understanding shared by indigenous knowledge holders as well as indigenous people all over the world. And I think that precept, that ethic, is really one of the most important kinds of contributions that indigenous knowledges are making and will make into the near future because of all the issues we're facing, you know, related to climate change, the need for and the challenge to gain some real understanding of what's happening in the environment and to be able to adapt to it in appropriate ways. And, of course, Native science has always been a sustainable science, and it has been a form of knowledge that has allowed Indigenous people to sustain and maintain themselves through generations. And so that's why there's an interest now, I think, momentum being gained, you know, with regard to the use and perspectives of Indigenous science in mainstream, you know, areas. But
speaking of momentum,
about it as well, I think, in terms of use and how it's going to be used.
Speaking of momentum, can you share with us how significant the Biden administration's acknowledgement of Indigenous traditional ecological knowledge is to your field and also to Indigenous academia?
Well, I think that it opens a door that is very important, particularly in areas that relate to creating cases for the preservation of sacred sites, the importance of Native languages and how Native languages convey, you know, this worldview and also this understanding of relationality within the context of our Indigenous communities. I think also it allows Native people to begin to really explore their own heritages, you know, which is really something I've always advocated, and that was the reason why I wrote Native Science. I should say that my background is as a field biologist. That was my first degree. And at the Institute of American Indian Arts, where I was a science teacher, I was challenged to create a curriculum that integrated science and art and the cultural perspectives of the students that were attending the Institute at that time. And, of course, I began to explore, you know, our heritage of Native science. And it, of course, is amazing. It has so many different kinds of perspectives and understandings of the natural world coming through various tribes through time and through generations. And so it is a really amazing storehouse of knowledge. But again, I think given the history of the way that academia has in many ways exploited, you know, knowledge systems of indigenous peoples, the way that the industry views this knowledge, and for example, in the Amazon, planting indigenous knowledge pertaining to certain kinds of plants, medicinal uses of certain plants, all of these are important areas to really begin to think about policies that are appropriate and also maintain the integrity of indigenous knowledge, but at the same time, allow it to be shared in appropriate and proper ways and respectful ways. And so I think that's going to be the big push, you know, with regard to the Biden proclamation, that these perspectives have already been well documented, well researched by indigenous peoples, indigenous scholars, and now it's going to become more a subject, you know, in mainstream context of academia and also in terms of government and policy making. So I think those are all advantages and positive outcomes of the Biden, you know, proclamation. But again, you know, it has to be done appropriately, respectfully, with the indigenous voices at the table, especially at the decision-making table, where some of these policies are implemented, you know, in government or in academia.
So while it's important to cite Indigenous knowledge in academic research, it's also important to invite the elders and the Indigenous knowledge keepers to the table, and then also have representation from different tribes, since not all knowledge translates to each tribe. Everyone has their own perspective on a subject, correct?
Right. There's, as I said, there's as many Indigenous knowledges as there are Indigenous tribes. Every tribe has its view of how its knowledge should be used and the context that are appropriate for that knowledge to be used. And I think all of that has to be understood and respected. There are certain protocols that should be in play, should be policy with regard to the use of such knowledge. Again, I mentioned exploitation as being one of the major issues of the past. Marginalization within academia has been also a major, concern. In terms of, for example, as a director of Native American Studies, the marginalization of Native studies within our higher education institutions has been a long-term concern. You know, and I think most directors of Native Studies programs would agree with that. You know, so I'm hoping that, you know, this proclamation has a widespread impact and effect, you know, with regard to some of these obstacles, you know, that are very real and have prevented, I think, a lot of Indigenous thoughts and perspectives moving further outside the context of just Indigenous circles. But again, I have to say, this is knowledge is alive and well within Indigenous circles, and I think that's to be said, and it's very important. And I really encourage Indigenous people themselves, young and old, to relearn their histories of Indigenous knowledge, and to be open to sharing where appropriate that knowledge in ways that allow us to adapt to some of the changes that we will have to adapt to as climate change becomes more pronounced, which it is.
Definitely.
And it impacts Indigenous communities the way it has.
Dr. Kahete, we actually have a caller that wants to ask you a question. It is Ansu from Los Angeles, California, listening online. Ansu, what's your question?
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I have actually bought Dr. Kahete's book, Igniting the Sparkle, and read it, and I'm extremely, you know, in awe of his contribution to challenge sort of the precepts of Western science exclusivity in the academy, and of raising the profile of Indigenous knowledge and sciences to the extent that we are where we are today. I would just like to throw in the point about the sort of cosmological and worldview underpinnings of Indigenous science. Because I feel there's a real, in all the discussions, I feel there's a real danger that the sort of empirical level of Indigenous traditional ecological knowledge gets sort of co-opted and folded into the Western science paradigm. The Western science sort of knowledge-making machine has been so effective at silencing, in other words, other worldviews, you know, ever since the 1600s. But that Western science way of knowing came about under very particular circumstances of civic and religious and political strife and real danger as the Catholic Church was being broken up in Europe in the 1600s. And the early, what they were then called, natural philosophers equally dabbled in other forms of knowing. They used theology, they used alchemy, Newton himself, known as the father of science, was known to write extensively about these other subjects. It's just that his official publications were in the realm of Western science, and it's characterized by a very exclusive shallow, narrow causal explanation where only you look at the immediate causes of it. You don't allow any sort of humanistic understanding or religious or spiritual or moral obligation question to enter into the realm of explanation of natural phenomena. So it's very purely and simply reduced to, do the observation and the data around you fit a theory, a mathematical theory? And that is so reductionist because it just excludes questions of, well, what are we doing on this earth? What is our moral obligation to this earth? This unrelenting search for sort of causal truth has eclipsed or overshadowed any other consideration of who we are on this planet and what we're doing. And that is so fundamental to indigenous cosmology, its ability to think about who we are as part of a greater world. And it's very comfortable in that cosmology and includes that in its way of producing empirical knowledge about the world.
Ansu, thank you for sharing this perspective. I assume that these are all coming from your readings and your interpretations of Dr. Kahete's books and your enjoyment of what he has published and put out there. Do you have a specific question for him before we go to break?
Would he like to comment on the cosmology underlying indigenous science and how it can be a real sort of challenge to the sort of Western science reductionism, you know?
And Dr. Kahete, I want to give you a moment to answer that, but I will probably have to cut you off to go to break, so we'll have you discuss it more after the break. So any quick thoughts on that before I let you talk further after the break?
No, I agree with everything that Ansu has said. Certainly, the cosmology piece is one of the bigger challenges for Western science, you know, and maybe the reason why it has been marginalized for so long within Western academia.
Thank you. Well, we're going to hear more from Dr. Kahete and also Larissa McLeod, and we're also going to bring in Dr. Shandon Peet after the break. So if you'd like to join our discussion today, call in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Every day we tackle issues from a Native viewpoint. And if you'd like to listen to any of our past shows, you can go on to SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. I'm your host, Alyssa London. We'll be right back after this short break.
With Christmas supplies and gifts in short supply, rest assured Prairie Edge and the Sioux Trading Post have you covered. Botanicals, craft supplies, beads, books, and music. We may not have it all, but we sure have a bunch at PrairieEdge.com who support this show. Wopila.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Alyssa London. We're talking about incorporating indigenous knowledge today. And if you're a student or past student, how do you balance your traditional understanding of the world and the Western sciences that you've studied? There's still time to join our conversation. We're at 1-800-996-2848. And if you're at a tribal college, how does indigenous knowledge make a presence in your classwork and research? So you can also call us at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Now, before the break, we were speaking with Dr. Gregory Kahete, a professor emeritus and former director of Native American Studies at the University of New Mexico, and he's Santa Clara Pueblo. We also have on the line today from Edmonton in Alberta, Canada, Larissa McLeod. She's a learning services librarian at the Alberta Library, and she's a member of the James Smith Cree Nation. We are also going to bring into the conversation now Dr. Shandon Peet. He's an assistant professor of teaching at the University of British Columbia in Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences, and he's Salish and Navajo. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Shandon.
Hello, hello. Nice to be here. Thanks, Alyssa, and been great to hear the conversation so far, very detailed and in-depth. Thank you.
Thank you. Assuming you were on the line also listening to the caller's comments, do you have any thoughts on what she was sharing with us?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things to talk about when we're speaking about Indigenous knowledges. And I think Gregory put it very well by saying that, you know, it's quite diverse, and it's there's many facets of it that are important and in operation today in our Indigenous communities. And I think most importantly, I think the biggest key words that I always try to mention when talking about Indigenous knowledge is that there's a intent and a purpose that are unique to each tribal community that really guide the knowledge production process that's happening in those individual cultural groups. And I think, you know, we sometimes get the waters a bit muddied by I think making this this compare and contrast scenario with Western science, when I think the young Indigenous scholar today is really looking more inward at our own communities to try to understand, you know, how our own knowledge systems work from within the community, with less worry about what you know, Indigenous science and the machine of industrialization is doing, but really trying to examine very critically what we think and how Indigenous knowledge operates to help and solve some of the pressing problems in our own communities. And so I kind of take this approach where, you know, I try to understand, first of all, from the very beginning of what the beginning of knowledge, you know, so try to understand what data is. What is data and how are we connected to that data? And what is our level of understanding? And I think right from the get-go, if we look at the different pursuits of knowledge from, say, the vast and multidisciplinary world of Western science, and again, from the vast multidisciplinary approach of Indigenous science, data can vary. The understanding of what counts as data and what doesn't count as data can vary. So even from that standpoint, then as data moves into information, where we start to contextualize that data, then we start to see a little bit more variance. So the pathway to knowledge, where then information becomes meaning, then you see this a bit of a divergence. But I suspect there's a large amount of overlap because the many different ways of learning and the pursuits of knowledge is really a human endeavor across our species, I think. And I think in a way we're kind of doing a bit of a disservice to our own pursuit of knowledge and understanding from an Indigenous perspective by really concerning ourselves overly, or I guess overly concerning ourselves with what maybe this larger body of knowledge production in Western science is doing, when really we should be strengthening our own traditions, reclaiming our own beliefs, and doing the work in our communities to manage the things that have been lost.
So from your perspective, some of the responsibility needs to go back to the tribal level to maintain and cultivate Indigenous knowledge and then relay that to the academic institutions?
Yeah, partially, I think. You know, there we have a long history of philosophers in each of our own traditional communities, and I think we're at a stage where, you know, we can make a decision on whether we want to engage in our communities outside with what we know and what we don't know. But I think through the history of federal policies and in the last couple decades, you know, we've had our beliefs fragmented quite a bit. So I think we're at a stage where we need to really examine some of the things that we're trying to reclaim and some of the things that maybe we don't want to reclaim. I mean, we have to come to terms that we live in a modern world, and we're surrounded by an economy that is far different than what our ancestors experienced. So really to reclaim something from the past, especially related to our knowledge production processes, we have to face the reality that it's a far different different world than the processes that we might be aiming for, or the exemplars that we want to maybe bring back. So whether or not that's that's something we want to share with the academic world. I think is in question, and I don't know what the purpose would be for that besides to, you know, aid in humanity overall. But I'm really a believer and an advocate for indigenous scholars coming up with our own ways of disseminating knowledge within our own communities, because we've been marginalized so much, and you know, we need to really strengthen ourselves so that we can illustrate our own knowledge systems to our own members, because sometimes we often don't agree.
You brought up an interesting thought, though, how we adapt Indigenous knowledge in the modern world, because if we're only referring back to Indigenous knowledge as it existed in the past, then it might not always apply to the world that we live in today. So how are you as a scholar and other Indigenous scholars, shoring up that divide?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, if you look back in time and at humans in general, you know, we're very practical species, and Indigenous folks, again, is, very practical. We seek knowledge that's going to be useful and have a purpose in our communities and in the worldview, or in the reality that we live in today. There's many things that are available to us that are far different than our ancestors. So when we see Indigenous folks getting educated at institutions, that's just a reflection of that practical purpose, where for some reason or another within our tribal communities, there's this push for folks to, in essence, you know, get some tools and skills outside of our own community to bring them back to assist us. So, you know, I'm not sure really exactly what the future looks like or holds for Indigenous communities. You know, we're all at different levels and different stages of need. One really good example is the revitalization of languages. You see much effort put into it, and in some places you see certain amounts of gain, and in other areas you see a lot of effort and not a lot of gain. So, you know, we need to, I hate to use the term modernize, but we really need to think practically about our needs and what skills and tools that we have available to us. And you can see this happen throughout history. You know, when the horse first arrived to us in the 1600s, we wholeheartedly adopted the use of that particular animal, and without thought of, you know, too much about what it might replace in our own lives. And the similar thing with firearms. We adopted the firearm, and in that way, a lot of the traditions of flint knapping and bow making, you know, went to the wayside. So we're practical. We adopt things, but really the core constructs and principles of our belief systems is really what guides us to use those things responsibly.
Thank you, Dr. Pete. Larissa, in the beginning of my conversation with Dr. Pete, he mentioned data and how data can vary in terms of what is counted and then how it's contextualized and then how that turns into information that meaning is applied to. From your background as a librarian, how do you think about data and how it can be not only cited better, but also indigenized?
Oh, that is an excellent question, and definitely a big part of the discussions within librarianship, and in particular within Indigenous librarianship, because I think when we often discuss data and information, whatever we decide to call it, when we're talking about important information, I think, like Dr. Kiete mentioned, we really connect with this concept of relationship. How does this data, you know, relate to this other data? And I think one of the things that we're starting to try and grapple with is also acknowledging that Indigenous knowledge is being plural, and recognizing that nations and communities are going to have different teachings and different, you know, words for things. they're going to have different stories, and it's important to acknowledge those. So I think grappling with that for sure. I think we definitely look into that a lot, and I don't think we have like a clear, you know, this is definitely the direction to head, but I think there is discussions around like, how do we make sure to be responsible to those relationships, to acknowledge them properly, to not kind of refer to like all Indigenous people as though there's a pan-Indigenous identity or teaching, to be able to respectfully acknowledge there are variations and differences is becoming super key, I think.
Thank you, Larissa. Dr. Cajete, when I was an undergraduate student at Stanford University, I took a lot of Native Studies classes, and something that stuck out to me is how it's, you know, segmented into its own department, and Native Studies wasn't integrated into my history classes or necessarily my anthropology classes or physics classes. It was always standalone. And it sounded like when we were talking in the last segment before the break that you have a desire, interest for Native Studies to permeate all subjects and not be its own standalone department?
Well, I think there actually is a need to have a standalone department in a university setting. But that being said, Native Studies programs in whatever institution you find them, you know, have their history that has interesting parallels with each other in the context of really being programs, and this is true for all ethnic studies programs that were born in the activist times of the 1960s. As students came and began to demand courses that were relevant to them, and particularly students of color, as they began to become socially and politically aware, began to demand courses that explored these questions, these issues within the context of the university. So for Native Studies programs, African American Studies programs, Women's Studies programs, Chicano Studies programs, all began really with that impetus in the 1960s on the part of students. And, of course, they came into the institution almost as a Trojan horse, not necessarily being welcomed, but because of the political forces that they represented, they were allotted a place, usually in the margins of the institution, and some of that history, unfortunately, continues, you know, within these institutions, the marginalizations of ethnic studies programs. But they served a very, very important purpose for both the students and the institutions, and continue to do so within the institutions now. But I do agree with the notion that Indigenous studies is a missing part of American history. There is no way enough time spent on Native histories, you know, and the telling of Native histories in our public schools. The need for the insights and the perspectives of Indigenous thought, I think, are things that have not only an appeal, but have an importance in the context of a well-rounded education, and they need to be a part of that. I think that Native Studies should be offered in junior high school level programs in our public schools, just to begin to address the need and the lack of that insight that they present.
Thank you for all the perspectives that you've shared today. Closing out our show, and I'm sorry to cut you off. There's always so much to share. And thank you, Dr. Pete, and also Larissa McLeod for being on our show today. We appreciate your perspectives. Dr. Cajete, if there is a place that we can go and learn more about your work, I know that it's in your books, and so I want everyone to Take an opportunity to Google Dr. Gregor Cahete and check out his books if you want to learn more about his perspective, since we weren't able to let him finish his thought. So thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. If you're interested in learning more about Indigenous knowledge, there are a number of additional resources and links and titles in our show notes at NativeAmericaCalling.com. You can also find a link to research by our guest, Dr. Shandon Peet, on topics such as the intersection of Indigenous water knowledge and hydrologic sciences. And you can also find a template developed by Larissa McLeod for citing Indigenous knowledge in your own research. So we've reached the end of our hour, and I'd like to thank again our guests, Dr. Gregory Cahete, Larissa McLeod, and Dr. Shandon Peet. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about preventing and treating traumatic brain injuries. I'm your host, Alyssa London, and this has been an episode of Native America Calling.
Uju, Mazanayagan Ayabaduk Jinananda Weaguyan de Bayage Siwan, Mino Mashkiki Yo, Tange Gwenenege Nongam. Kanoje no ki de Nishinabe Akuzi Wagamigung no Wajjige Kendaman, Mawadishiwain Healthcare.gov, Gema Ganoj 1-800-318-2596. Gaundinagadeg the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.